Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in a hat.
We are both chefs here in downtown Seattle. Happy that you've tuned in here every Saturday and Sunday for a couple hours. Except when those pesky Seahawks take our space. And then you just have to listen to our podcast online.
We should make a deal with them. If they keep winning, we void the show. Otherwise, it's not worth it.
It's not worth it. Okay. I have several restaurants here in downtown Seattle and this lovely cooking school, which, by the way, you know, we have another one of our Food Lovers Weekends coming up here, the 18th, 19th, and 20th of October. It's 2.5 days of bliss. 2.5 days.
How many guests?
We're cooking from the book. So each of the chefs has picked their favorite cookbook, and we're doing recipes from the book.
Which one did you pick?
I picked Goat, Cooking and Eating by James Wetler.
I love that. I love the title, Goat.
But I'm going to bring in a whole goat. It's going to be processed, and then we're going to break it down, and I'm going to make some different goat dishes. That's one segment of 20.
So wow.
It's going to be a long weekend. You better bring your...
How does one make a reservation for that?
I don't know. You got to go to hotstovesociety.com and figure it out.
Okay.
All right. We have a new sponsor. Our only sponsor. We appreciate that. We have... We want to share with you a fun event happening out there. The farmers, producers, and chefs of Whidbey Island are passionate about what they do and where they live. As a matter of fact, where they live. Give me a break. I drove through Bellingham and that Camino Island area yesterday. Unbelievably beautiful. Gotta say, at the end of the growing season, it's time to share the bounty of the land during Whidbey Island Grown Week, a 10-day celebration of local products, services, and experiences coming up September 27th to October 6th. Learn more at WhidbeyCaminoIslands.com/Seattle Kitchen, and you can also go over to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. We've posted all about it there as well.
Yeah, it is something to remember. You know, going to the islands is such a beautiful, beautiful day.
We were on our way to Vancouver. I had an event in Vancouver this weekend, and I just wanted to stop there. I didn't want to go any further. It was so beautiful.
Yeah, I was just on Shaw Island a couple of weeks ago, which is, you know, in the San Juan.
A little bit north, yeah.
But still, I mean, you go through this whole valley and the Skagit Valley and everything. It's so beautiful down there.
Very lovely. On today's show, we're going to answer your culinary quandaries. Cairo's Rachel Bell is here, and as you know, she loves to hog the mic, so we got to get in our words before she shows up. She went to have family meal at Canlis Restaurant. Tyler and Sarah Hansen are here from the Oyster Catcher in Coopville. We're happy to talk to them today and their whole Camino Island and Whidbey Islands group. Your culinary questions asked and answered, and of course, your food for thought. Tasty Trivia wraps up our show at the end of hour number two. So you don't want to miss that. Hang with us, and we'll be there, here, the whole show. Ordinary to Extraordinary Chef.
Yes, sir.
I think of you as a baker chef, because I know you love pastry, too. But do you ever make scones? I think they're kind
no.
of British, right?
That, no? Yeah, it's
okay,
very British.
I'm not gonna ask you how to make them extraordinary, though. Tina apparently really wants popcorn to be extraordinary, because she put it twice on our list of things to talk about. So... this last weekend at the zoo party, I don't know if your group did the zoo party on last
Friday. I was not there, but I know about it.
Yeah, Lola did Marmite popcorn.
Oh, wow.
Marmite.
The three guys from New Zealand must have been really excited.
Yeah, exactly. all 1,500 people had a bag, and it was quite delicious. How would you make popcorn extraordinary? Do you ever make it from scratch?
Yeah.
I know you're not a microwave guy.
No. From in a pot, like normally, like... I didn't even know you could put it in a microwave. That would explode my microwave.
Yeah, of course.
Which
you didn't.
I don't have one.
Of course you didn't know.
So
yeah.
Anyway, in a pot with just a little dash of clarified butter,
mm-hmm.
and then to me, I like to use your mushroom rub. And this is not a plug for Tom Douglas. This is I happen to have your rubs in my cupboard. I know that's not a secret, but the mushroom rub, I think it's really nice because it's very savory. And it has a little bit of that mushroom mustiness,
mm-hmm.
and I think it sticks to the popcorn really well. You know, you let your popcorn pop, and then you drop the spice rub right on top of that.
After it's popped,
and then you toss it around, and it's a really delicious, delicious combination: mm-hmm. corn and mushroom. I think it's really good.
I like it. You know what I like? I like creating a little, like, you know how when you invite people over for a pizza party and you kind of just put the toppings out and people get to top
them up?
I do the same thing for a popcorn party. At least I did when Loretta was still eating popcorn as a teenager. This wasn't a youngster popcorn.
And now she's married and gone.
But things like rosemary and garlic butter and brown butter and caramel. And so you can make your own caramel sauce.
Sure.
You can make your own savory rosemary garlic popcorn. And then lots of different flavored salts. Smoked sea salt is really good on popcorn, fresh butter.
It's a very
popcorn.
Good way to do a party entertainment and not very expensive.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very, very efficient way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on a little budget, that's a great way to do it.
I would agree. Now, the last thing I'm going to ask you, Chef, because this is another one. I'm not sure where Tina was this weekend. I think she was maybe at the fair, the Puyallup Fair.
It's fair season.
It's fair season.
Let's go to the fair.
They don't call it the Puyallup anymore, right? It's the
Washington State Fair. I liked it when you could do it at a trot.
Down to the Puyallup Fair. Going to see and do everything that's there. It's going to take 2 days or three. Come along down with me.
Nicely done. Yeah. Dumb Douglas, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Round of applause.
Yeah.
You can tell he made his debut on Cairo.
Anyway, hot dogs. Other than caramelized onions.
We call them saucies where I come from. I'm a big fan of making sausages, you know, and putting them in between two pieces of bread. But hot dog, it's hard. It's not something I eat commonly. Last hot dog I had was with you, as a matter of fact, was...
At the baseball game? Where?
No. It was at Costco. You told me about the Costco hot dog, and I'm like, well, whatever. And we had the Costco hot dog because you like the pop or something like this. And I'm like,
I like the snap.
It tastes like a hot dog.
Yeah.
Definitely does.
You know, that Costco dog I thought was so cheap 20 years ago when it came out of the $1.50, and it's still $1.50, including a beverage.
How do they do it? They haven't heard of increase?
Well, it gives you an idea of what hot dogs are made of.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Not a lot of margin there.
I think in the world we live in today, you go to Hooli's and you buy some nice sausages and put that in between two pieces of bread and you'll have a great hot dog.
So any sausage for you would make it extraordinary, other than kind of the pureed classic Oscar Mayer wiener.
Right. I'm not a big fan of something on a roller that's been there for 2 hours, 10 hours, and you don't even know what's in it. I kind of have a little problem with that, as in I'm not that hungry ever, even when I'm starved.
Well, here's what I would say to you. Don't go into a 7-Eleven. I went into my first 7-Eleven maybe in 10 years, and they have this entire counter, the length of our studio here, with rollers, and they have everything on there from hot dogs and sausages to taquitos to you name it.
Taquitos on the roller, too?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'd never seen such a thing. They have a whole industry now with rollable foodstuffs. Did you guys all know that? Am I just living in the last century? Oh, they're shaking their head like they all know this.
Everybody knows that.
The answer is
they
yes.
All know. Okay. Sean knows this. Yeah. Are you a taquito man?
They're pretty gut-bombing.
Okay. All right. Up next, Rachel Bell from the Cairo Radio is going to join us to talk about her experience with Family Meal at Camillus on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. We're having a little ad-lib competition between Rachel Bell and Tina Knoll, our producer. Welcome to the show, Rachel. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
And why are you here, dear? You're bothering us.
I am so sorry to bother you, but I wanted to know if you wanted to buy some Girl Scout cookies. I am here because I have a podcast. It's called Your Last Meal. Mm-hmm. You were on my very first episode.
How about that?
I know. And I ask celebrities about what they would eat for their last meal. And then we get into the history, the science, the culture of that food. So recently I had Duff McKagan as my guest. He's the bassist from Guns N' Roses. And his last meal was so different than anything anyone had ever said. So he moved from Seattle to Los Angeles, I think it was 1983, maybe 1984, and he immediately got a job at the Black Angus Steakhouse, which is a chain. He rolled into town, just went straight there and got a job. So
Stuart Anderson used to own Black Angus, right?
I don't know who that is. Big local guy.
Oh. He does senior housing now.
Oh, okay. And so as he was talking about at that time, and still to this day, there were a lot of people from Latin America working in the kitchen. At that time, people from El Salvador specifically. And so every day they would get their family meal. For people who don't know, family meal, sometimes it's called staff meal, is the meal that people working at a restaurant will eat before service or after service, where they cook something that is not on the menu that, you know, they're eating together before they have to get work in. So the staff meal at that time at the Black Angus was chicken teriyaki and either rice or a baked potato. But these Latin Americans working in the kitchen were like, we don't want this. So what they would do was they would just kind of pull stuff from other parts of the kitchen. They would take the chicken teriyaki, they would pair it with pineapple that they would grill, avocado, and jalapeno. And this is Duff McKagan's last meal, is this family meal he had in 1984 in the Black Angus kitchen. And all of these years, he's made it for his family. His daughters are grown. They now make it for their friends. So, like I said on the show, we kind of spin off of the last meal and take it in a different direction. So I was like, well, I want to go and have family meal at a restaurant in Seattle. And I learned that Canlis, which is arguably the city's most Tony restaurant around since 1950, very fancy. You need to wear a suit, a jacket to go in. They take their family meal very seriously. They have a rule, and I'm interested to know what family meal is like in your restaurants. At their restaurant, you have to come sit down in the dining room. They don't want people standing over the stove. They don't want people in the corner by themselves making lists. They want it to actually be a resting time, a nourishing time, and a time to get to just sit and chat and have fun with your coworkers quickly before service starts for the night.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. Do you want to know what it was?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, we're curious. Right.
We're just waiting.
I'm giving away the whole podcast. So I love family meal because I love the juxtaposition of what people are eating as guests and then what people who work there are eating. So at Canlis, where they're serving very precious food, you know, a lot of the tweezery kind of food, what are they eating in the back? So they set it up like a buffet in the dining room. And the day that I was there, it was lamb gyros. They had flatbread. They had homemade tzatziki and fresh summer tomatoes and cucumbers. They had what my favorite was, like this big bowl of stewed Japanese eggplant with all kinds of wild mushrooms, like hen of the woods. They had a lot of roasted broccoli. They had a big salad that had seeds and nuts in it. And then for dessert, they had like a very fluffy coffee cake with that crumbly streusel on the top. And it was really good. And they plan everything weeks in advance. And everybody has their role. Like pastry does the dessert. Somebody does the salad. Somebody does the main meal.
Do they take reservations? Sounds delicious.
I know.
You know what? They should start a trend. Charge for family meal and invite people over.
Well,
a different service. The service before the service.
Yeah, there are cookbooks out now that are just focused on family meal because people have gotten so curious about what the staff are making. And it's a kind of a time to show off. So it's people in the kitchen who, you know, you're only cooking what's on the menu. You don't get to show your personal style.
Right.
So they get to cook whatever they want, be it a dish from where they're from. They said that sometimes people have kind of moved up the ranks because of the food that they've cooked in family meal. But if you make a bad family meal, no one is going to let you live it down.
No.
So some favorites are that they've done there is like fried chicken sandwiches, lasagna. It sounds like it's usually kind of like comfort food, but then they make sure and do a lot of vegetables because you don't want to be, you know, tired and lethargic at the start of your shift. Because these sous chefs, they're there for 12, 13 hours a day. And so at Canlis, they actually do two family meals. They do one at 11 and one at 4 p.m. sharp. So what is family meal like in your restaurants?
So at Luc, we make staff meal, and it comes out after the service every night. And it's great. Like you said, I think what's cool is the cooks really take a pride in making something of their own, which is because it's never, very rarely is it something from the menu. It's usually something that we have in the house that they have made into a different dish. So it's really fun to, you know, often I come by and I'm like, oh, what are you guys making?
I know, exactly.
I'm like, wow, that's really good.
I love that part.
You know, it's very, very fun to watch. You know, and everybody puts their own touch. And like you said, it's very pride, too. I mean, lots of pride. You know, it's like, hey, I'm cooking for the staff. And you know they're going to chop you down if you don't make it cook.
Exactly.
I always think of it, my favorite family meals were the ones when you had the different immigrant waves come through the restaurants over the last 30 years, whether it was the Vietnamese wave or the Polish or... It's funny to think back at all the different immigration waves that we have. I think the Sudan. I think back at those meals of getting something different, and certainly the Latinx wave has been around for years and years, not so much anymore. But that is my idea of what family meal and the expression of your own self is learning from all these immigrants that come in. And, you know, restaurant work is perfect work because you get shown once and you can repeat the job no matter what language you speak, right?
Well, that's what Duff was saying was at the time when he was working at the Black Angus, a lot of people from El Salvador, he was working with a professor, he said, that at that time they were trying to get rid of intellectuals, and so he was forced to leave his country. And so that's the thing that's interesting about food in general is how much politics and immigration, you know, finds its way into food. And it's like we just take for granted in the States, like, oh, we have food from all over the world. And it's like, well, that's for a reason, you know? know? I mean, people were forced to come here. Some people chose to come here. But most people were leaving someplace that was inhospitable to come here. And then to make ends meet, they took up cooking, even though they had never done it before in their country.
I had a pantry guy one time at Rovers who was a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he came to America and because he had to run out. And he came here, but he was a doctor in his country and came here and was working in a pantry in the garde manger station in Rover. So.
Yeah.
One of my favorites, his name was Kamsa Vangseltup, I want to say is his last name. Kamsa Vangseltup is a Lao guy who swam across the river to escape, you know, amid gunfire and the whole thing. But just this tiny little guy, and his wife would bring him spring rolls every day for his meal. Because a lot of times they just don't eat our food at all.
Right.
It's just not good to them, or is that comfortable? So they were so good. He had a little peanut vinegar to go with the spring rolls that I hired her to make spring rolls full time.
I put them
on the menu at Cafe Sport. Absolutely.
See, that's how it happens.
Yeah.
I was thinking, what would it be like in this country if every industry had family meal? Like, what if at Cairo they were giving us food every day? We didn't have to bring our own lunch. And based on from what I see on our free table in the middle, I think that our family meal would be a quarter of a cake from someone's son's graduation from 3 days ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And the leftover cold cuts covered in like a plastic clamshell.
And some Doritos.
Yeah, lots of sloppy seconds and mayonnaise packets.
There's been a lot of chatter about that kid who only ate, potato chips and something, and he went
blind.
Yes. You'd be blind.
Oh, man.
Which is okay on the radio.
Next Stevie Wonder. Yeah, I don't need these eyes. Yeah. All I need are Doritos and white bread.
And that lovely voice of yours.
It's my moneymaker, baby.
There you go. That's been Rachel Bell, Cairo Personality. It's your podcast is called?
It's called Your Last Meal. You can listen wherever you find podcasts, like where you found this one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just like Seattle Kitchen. All right, up next, it's the Chef Tyler Hansen of the Oyster Catcher up there on Whidbey Island. Looking forward to chatting with him and seeing what's going on in Coopville and all the fun things going on in the Whidbey Camino Island Group.
Can't wait to hear.
I know. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Rachel Bell is a piece of work.
She's awesome.
She's such a radio natural. I love listening to her yak away. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
As you have been listening for the last few weeks, we've been enjoying our time with the Whidbey Camino Islands.com group, talking about Whidbey Island Grown Week, a 10-day celebration of local products, services, and experiences. And today, from Coopville, we have Sarah and Tyler Hansen from the Oyster Catcher restaurant. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Now, where's Susan Vanderbeek these days? That's all I want to know.
Susan's in Portland.
Is she in Portland now?
Enjoying retirement, yep.
Oh, good. You bought it from her, right?
No, we're the third owners.
You're the third owners.
So we bought it from Joe and Jamie Scott, and they bought it from Susan.
Because Chef, you remember Susan?
Oh yeah, no, I remember very well. Yeah,
down at Cafe Campari.
I was going to ask that question too. I was going to ask the same question. Mm-hmm. We know where is Susan these days, and that's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool
to know she's retired. Know too.
Do they?
They love that.
Yeah,
time.
She's a sweetheart.
She pops in to check on us once in a while. So
I like it. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the restaurant a little bit before we get started, and what you're trying to do there. Either one of you?
Yeah. So we've had it for about 6 years now, mm-hmm. and just really focused on kind of using the bounty of the island and what we have there. We now have a bakery as well, the Little Red Hen Bakery, that just has kind of grown naturally over the last few years. And I started baking bread in Dutch ovens in our ovens in the restaurant to have fresh bread at the restaurant, and everybody wanted to buy it and just kind of took off from there.
Tell me about that a little bit before we move on. Just does a Dutch oven give it a nice crusty edge?
Yeah,
instead
of injecting steam into the oven like we have now in our commercial bread oven, having that lid on there in a preheated Dutch oven, it keeps all that steam in, so you get the nice oven spring, the rise. Then you take the lid off, give it the final bake with get that crust on it, and it works fantastically.
So when you take the lid off, do you still leave it in the Dutch oven?
Yep.
And let it finish there?
Yeah, just leave it in there. You get amazing results that way.
Sounds beautiful. Mm-hmm. It sounds very organic.
Sounds a very nice, easy way to start, because buying a Dutch oven is not that bad. You could find a used one.
$20,
for it's an easy way to start,
Yep.
So do you do leaven? What do you do for rising?
All of our bread is naturally leavened. We're using Fairhaven organic flour from Burlington, as well as Karen Springs flowers.
And growing our own?
And growing our own flour.
No way!
Yep.
Tell me about that, Sarah.
We work with the bishops, one of the families who have lots on the prairie out there, and they grow some wheat for us, and we actually have a 100% EB's reserve loaf that's made with all the wheat we've grown out there. It's really nice.
And we mill that in-house, too.
Do you thrash it and mill it and everything?
They thrash it for
they
us.
Thrash, right.
We actually have a bunch of wheat that needs to be cleaned if you want to come up
I'm going to leave that to you, Sarah.
This is nice. This is a perfect place to do this. Yeah. You might get 10 people.
Yeah, when we, I can take a picture of our wheat field, and you've got Rosario Strait in the back, and then Port Townsend, and then the Olympic Mountains. It's really quite a sight.
Spectacular. As I said earlier, I was driving through the area, not over on the island, but certainly down I-5 through Bellingham and that little valley there.
Skagit.
Mount Vernon area. Yeah. That's such a spectacular sight.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So what else is grown on Whidbey? Last time I was, I should say the first time, 30, 40 years ago when I first went to Whidbey, it was all about loganberries for the big, because St. Michelle was doing this whole thing with loganberry liqueur. I don't know if they still do it or not.
Do they
still have that product?
Yeah. I don't know if St. Michelle does, but we have Whidbey Island Distillery that does loganberry, blackberry, raspberry, all kinds of berry liqueurs. Uh-huh. They do whiskey as well now. So.
And they're going to start growing on the prairie as well,
yep,
I believe, with the bishops.
They've got some locally grown barley that they're going to have malted and do that. So, as far as other things around the island, when you're asking about our business and the restaurant and the bakery and everything, I think the best way to kind of sum up what we do and sum up the island is our Reuben sandwich.
Really?
It's relatable. Everybody knows a Reuben, but, we bake our bread, and that takes 3 days to make our bread. We brine the pastrami. The brisket comes from Three Sisters Market, which is right across the cove from us. We actually grew the cabbage that we then turn into sauerkraut this year. We make mayonnaise out of local eggs from Wellborn Farms and then make the Russian dressing with that.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't started Cave Asian cheese yet, so when we do that, we'll stop buying the Gruyere from Switzerland. But, other than that, that's...
Use that Samus Bay Gouda or something
like
that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. We'll get some local stuff. So that's kind of... That sums up how we approach the restaurant and the bakery, what we like to do there.
That's fantastic.
And I bet it's delicious, too.
Yeah.
I love a good Reuben sandwich. They're kind of trashy good, with the Russian dressing. And that's my highest level of praise is when I call something trashy good. That is high praise from me. So it's like the prawns I used to like to eat, the coconut prawns.
We used to eat fried coconut prawn after our show when we used to be on Cairo on East Lake. We stop in that place, and once in a while, we'd have trashy prawns.
Oh, yeah. Until Terry got thrown out for being a gangster, he wasn't allowed to wear his hat because it was gang-related. Remember that,
Chef? Yeah, that was in the...
Then we got thrown out of the place with the trashy prawns, so then...
Some guy came to me and said, "You can't wear a hat," and I said... Well, I can't be the chef in the hat without a hat. So
They considered it gang-related, his fedora, and so we had to leave the restaurant. So.
I mean, I look like a gangster like nobody's business, if you know what I mean.
Oyster catcher. That's, if somebody doesn't like oysters, they probably aren't going to walk in your front door. But we all know that that's just the name, right? Because that's a big business up there on Whidbey. You're right across from all the Penn Cove mussel floats. Is that true?
They're just a little down the water. But, you look out on Penn Cove, and it's really cool to get a nice, delicious bowl of mussels, look out on the cove, and know that's where they came from.
Right.
Really great, bountiful source there. The Penn Cove mussels are smaller than most mussels that people are used to, and they're a little bit sweeter. Obviously, I'm partial to them and living there.
You should be.
They're
right next door to you.
They are right next door, and one of the managers lives right next door to me as well.
And the oyster catcher was actually Susan Vanderbeek's favorite bird, so that's where the restaurant got its name.
Really?
Has nothing to do with oysters, actually. It's just a bird.
She got chased down a beach in New Zealand by an oyster catcher or something, and I think was the story she gave me. Because I had to ask her, because everyone was trying to figure out where the name came from. She's like, "I think it was that." And so.
All right, so this Whidbey Island Grown Week, it's the 27th to the 6th, 27th of September to the 6th of October.
Yep.
How are you participating? Are some of your neighbors participating? And certainly probably some of the farmers you work with are participating. Tell us about the week.
Yeah, so it's a great kind of showcase of what Whidbey Island is, and just a lot of collaboration happens that week with various people. The first Saturday, I believe it's the 28th, we're going to be cooking some wood-fired pizzas at the Cider Festival. It's the third year for the Cider Fest. That's at Pacific Rim Institute. A bunch of cideries from around Washington, mm-hmm. as well as some distilleries. Kids can go out there and press fresh apple cider. You can bring your apples there. They have experts that will tell you what kind of apple you have in your yard.
Really?
Which I think is pretty cool.
That's pretty
everybody
cool.
always asks, like, what kind of apple is that? I have no idea.
Yeah.
And boy only knows how many we have.
Yeah. we're doing that. On Monday night, we're doing kind of a collaboration dinner with myself, Michael Tu, who has Wellborn Farm. He's also the chef at Farmer in the Vine. And then all the proceeds from that are going to the Coopville School Foundation. It's a brand new program this year, all from scratch cooking in all of the Coopville schools, which is really cool.
That's awesome.
And they're growing, using local purveyors mm-hmm. as well.
Nice.
So they hired another chef from, used to have a restaurant in Coopville. He's the chef at the schools now. And they're buying our bread from the bakery. It's really an awesome program. So we're excited to support that.
Yeah, no kidding.
And the later weekend, the 5th and 6th, is the Harvest Festival in Langley. So all kinds of food. There's workshops and conferences and talks mm-hmm. and things like that. So a lot of fun stuff to do.
If you've never been to Langley, the Inn at Langley is there, and it's a great place to kind of, if you want to spend the night, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just hang out and do the festival a couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
That's a beautiful inn. And Chef Matt Costello used to be a chef with me down here at some of our restaurants.
Oh, really?
Has been up there for years now, and I think he might even be part owner at this point.
He is part owner.
He is part owner.
He's a fantastic man.
He's a good man. Yeah. And
he cares,
lovely,
and he does a lot. He does a
lovely
beautiful
cook.
Job.
Yeah,
beautiful
lovely
job.
Cook. Yeah. So it's good fun to hang out up there. And, of course, there's Willows, and there's mm-hmm. – I don't know if they're part of that or not, the Lumi Island.
No, they're
a little further north.
Further north by Bellingham.
Okay. All right. Well, get on a ferry, go over to Whidbey, go up to Camino Island, whatever it is that you have to do to enjoy some of the beauty and the bounty of our beautiful state would be awesome. 27th to the 6th. 27th of September to the 6th. We've been talking with – Sarah and Tyler Hansen of the Oyster Catcher Restaurant. And, Chef, you and I are due for a visit.
I am definitely dying to go for a visit. It's not going to happen on the 28th weekend, but it's going to happen soon.
All right.
I have to go back.
I love that area. And, of course, we can go visit Ian and Raul at Pen Cove Oyster and Mussel Farms.
Eat some mussels right off the shore.
All right, up next, questions from you, our listeners, that we grabbed off of our Facebook page over the weekend on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. Chef, how are you doing today?
I am so beautiful. I am so excited. The rain has watered my lawn just after my son mowed the grass.
Good.
That's extremely, extremely exciting to me.
Your son still mows the grass.
Well, he needs something. So I said, the lawn needs to be mowed.
I thought he was a diver.
Well, I got two sons.
Oh.
One came to borrow something, and I said, sure. And then Kathy goes, could you mow the lawn, by the way? Oh, sure, no problem.
Wow.
Very nice.
Well, that's a good son.
Well, yeah, it's just... Yes, very good
indeed.
Song. Extremely nice. He was just very happy to do it. So.
There you go. I'm Tom Douglas, and we're going to invite Tina Knoll, our producer, to check out our Facebook page.
Yes.
And tell us the burning questions that people have
lots
for this incredible expertise in front of you.
Yes. It's not often that you get to go directly to chefs like you two and get your expert questions answered. So... on our Facebook page, Gail Good Schreibers is asking a question about a kitchen makeover. She says she has an electric stovetop. She's had it for years, but she's considering switching to gas. She's not much of a stovetop cook. She prefers baking, roasting, and grilling, but is wondering from a home value standpoint, does it make sense to switch to gas?
Not if the city of Seattle gets their way.
That's still, she could do it now. It's grandfathered, but the city of Seattle is trying to outlaw gas, natural gas, right now. So it's interesting times in our city, so I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Would I switch to gas? I probably would if I had the opportunity, certainly. But sometimes, you know, just because gas is there doesn't mean it's been brought to your doorstep. Mm-hmm. So that could be a $10,000 decision. I'm not sure where it stands in your neighborhood.
What about from a cooking standpoint?
I would go to gas from a cooking standpoint.
And why? What's the benefit there?
It's a little bit more controllable. What do you think, Jeff?
It seems to be more manageable. I think, I have made a turnaround on that one. I'm not against gas or against electricity. But I think that, you know, there are some very good stovetop that are heat radiant, like electrical.
Mm-hmm. Like induction burners, you
mean. Like induction burner. Yeah. That are actually really, really cool to work with. And they're very, very, you know, you remove the pan, you have no heat. There's no pollution.
They're very responsive.
Very responsive. And you can also manage your heat. You know, it's just, it's like anything else. You have to get used to it. I started at 14 years old on a probably 20-foot long coal stove. Flat top, nothing but flat top. No burners, just flat top. And
coal fired.
Coal, yeah. We had to refill the stove 3 times a day. And with fresh coal, and you know, you just learn to work with any kind of heat source you have. Obviously, that's, you know, that's passé for the coal, but you know, I think that if she's used to her electric stove, and she's not as giant of a cook as she seems to mention, I mean, there is no need to change unless, you know, you've got money to burn and want to satisfy yourself with a new stove. Go right ahead.
All right, Adam Seaman is asking a question about how to make crepes. Sweet or savory? Any ideas?
Ooh, that sounds like a chef of the chapeau question.
Yes. Crepes, you ready? Just put some flour in a bowl. And by the way, when I say this, it's because there is no measurement. Just kidding.
Really?
Well, for many, many years. I actually have written a recipe for crepes. And I'll gladly give it to you.
We'll put it on
our Facebook page. But yeah. For many, 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 many years, I've never weighed a crepe recipe because I learned from my mom, and my mom never weighed a recipe either. You know, you put some flour in a bowl, you put a couple eggs, you whisk them into that with a little sugar, a tiny pinch of salt, and then you pour in your milk on top of that. That's if you want to make a sweet crepe. If you want to make a savory crepe, my recommendation is using buckwheat flour, which is a lot different in terms of texture. It's also no gluten, so you get gluten-free.
Yeah.
But the consistency is very different. It's a little bit more gooey. It looks like what falls off of okra vegetable. You know, it's kind of like that consistency. But it makes a great savory crepe. You know, more salt and pepper in it, and some fresh herb, and then you bake your crepe like that. You put it in the pan with a little butter first, and then do your crepe like this, and then you can stuff it with some leftover roasted chicken, with goat cheese, and maybe some mushroom, and have a wonderful crepe. Mm. That would be my recommendation.
I love crepes.
Buckwheat for savory.
Yep.
And then wheat flour for sweet.
And sometimes you can make the savory crepes with buckwheat if you use, instead of water or milk, you can use
beer.
Hard cider is what I was going to say.
Hard cider or beer.
Or beer, yeah.
You go, if you ever have a chance to go through Normandy or Brittany in France, you owe it to yourself to drive through the countryside, and suddenly you're going to see a sign that says creperie. And you gotta stop, and you're gonna be surprised. There's 150 people in that restaurant, cars parked in the middle of a field, and you're like, where the heck are these people coming from? And you go in there, and it's a full menu just made with crepe, savory and sweet.
Oh,
and a big bowl of cider on the
delightful.
Side. Raw cider, and it's delicious.
All right, your last question. Michelle Duncan wants to know what to do with a Costco rotisserie chicken for leftovers other than soup.
Boy, there's so much.
So many you can do.
You take one, I'll take one.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm a stir fry guy because when I'm working leftovers, I'm trying to clean out the fridge, and so I'm using that last half onion that wasn't used. I'm using the single couple carrots or celeries that were left over from making stock, or I'm using. I always have crimini mushrooms around because I love
leftover rice.
Leftover rice. You can make a stir fry or just just a stir-fry without the rice even. You don't need the noodles or the rice. And then everything I've got that's left over is a perfect combination for that. If you don't have enough of the chicken, just scramble a few eggs like you do in a fried rice and just add a few scrambled eggs to your stir-fry. Now you've got enough protein to make yourself
That's what
happy.
I was going
to
do is make a nice little...
Or tofu.
Yep. Yeah, tofu would be good, but oftentimes when I buy tofu, I use the whole brick. I don't have some left over.
So I would just crumble the pieces of chicken or slice it, either way, or depends on the part you have left. Put that in the oven for a minute just to warm it up, and then make a nice, beautiful sandwich. Right now you have heirloom tomato, basil, avocados, and put your chicken in the middle of that. I know it sounds simple, but it's really delicious this time of year. Mm-hmm. Mm. And if you don't have the bread, you can just make that, take the bread, cut it into small croutons, toss it in a pan with some olive oil, make a wonderful salad with the whole thing, and a wonderful tomato, avocado, chicken, and crouton salad.
Mm.
Great lunch. I'm hungry already. Where is that sandwich, Tom?
You know, one thing I always seem to have around the fridge is the chunk of grateable cheese.
Yeah.
I always seem to have a half a jar of salsa or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And I always have corn tortillas.
Yeah.
And so a quick little, just take your pulled chicken and your salsa, mix it together. Take your tortillas and give them a quick fry.
Yeah.
Not a crispy fry, but just a quick fry. And then wrap up little enchiladas and put the rest of your salsa and grated cheese on top, bake them up, and you've got delicious chicken enchiladas that make that roast chicken that you originally bought seem like a long time ago.
Oh, yeah.
It takes you to, it transports you, right, to a whole different place.
Exactly. You know, a completely different meal.
Yeah.
You could even make a pasta. I mean, if you had pasta, you just use that as a base and take your chicken, saute it in a pan with some onions, mushroom, little crumbled cheese, put that all over it, even some heirloom tomato, little white wine, reduce that down, dash of cream, and put that right over your pasta, and you'd have a wonderful creamed chicken pasta.
Speaking of pasta, last night Jackie made caponata from all the veggies from the farm. She brought home eggplant, tomatoes, peppers, onions.
And she has a lot.
Oh, yeah, she has a lot. And we had 50 totes of peppers this last week. Anyway, she made a little pasta caponata, and it was delicious, exactly what you kind of just described. Okay, up next, we're going to use, we have so many peppers that we're going to use peppers in every course of a dinner party that we're putting on for you, our faithful listeners, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Thank you for joining us. Our audience is busy munching on their breakfast sandwich, which comes with your $20 ticket. It's a bargain around here, I got to tell you.
It is a bargain.
It's a bargain. Welcome back. Thanks for hanging through the long break. We appreciate it. We're here 2 hours every Saturday and Sunday. If not live on the air, then you can get our podcast off of the Cairo or your favorite podcast base, home base for your favorite podcast. You know, we want to share with you a fun event happening out there. It's the farmers, producers, and chefs of Whidbey Island are passionate about what they do and where they live. At the end of the growing season, it's time to share that bounty from the land during the Whidbey Island Grown Week, a 10-day celebration of local products, services, and experiences coming up September 27th to October 6th. Learn more at whidbeycaminoislands.com/Seattle Kitchen. You can also go over to our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. We've posted all about it there as well. Super fun event coming up. We're going to do a dinner party, and we're going to use peppers in every course because this last week, my chefs are crying. There's so many peppers, my chefs are crying.
They need ideas.
Yeah, exactly. So this last week, Jackie and I had to come down on Saturday to, we spent 8 hours doing production work on Prosser Farm vegetables because we're at the peak of the season right now. This cool weather is going to slow things down, but man, we were bursting at the seams. And so a tote is 20 pounds, and so we had 40 totes of peppers, we had 50 totes of tomatoes, and all after the restaurants had taken everything they could take. 25 totes of cucumbers, and you know,
this is when grandma is really, you know, nice to have around and start canning.
So I went to the restaurant supply store and bought 45-gallon buckets with lids because we're going to pickle these peppers right now and put them in the walk-in refrigerator that we have at the palace, and they'll be good all winter long. Just a simple vinegar brine on them with a vinegar. I used 4 distilled vinegars to 1 cider vinegar. These are gallon measures.
Sure.
To 1 cup of salt and 1 cup of sugar and then some spices. And that's how we pickled our peppers.
Very nice.
They're going to be good. And you can have them on our menus all winter long. It's going to taste like summer bounty. Anyway, let's use them in a menu, real quick menu, because Peter is coming for dinner.
Peter Piper.
No, Peter Piper. Because He picked peppers and then pickled them.
Yes.
Because he couldn't pick a pack of pickled peppers unless they were packed in a bushel or on a branch.
Oh, in a pack. They were packed in a in the branch.
I'm not sure how. You're starting off, though. I'm tongue-tied for some reason.
Well, I'm going to take your pickled paper and make a vodka martini with pickled paper in it.
Delicious.
I think that would be delicious.
Now
to
Peter Piper is going to talk like he's going to be slurring his words because he's had a martini.
After that martini, I'm going to dare you say that again.
Yeah. He's not going to be able to speak with this. All his peas are going to run together.
Yeah, no, I think a nice little pepper vodka cocktail would be a delicious way to start the evening.
All right.
You could even put some on a little toothpick right on top of your martini and use that instead of the olive. Use a dirty pepper.
Good. I'm going to do a fried shrimp appetizer. And I'm going to just take the dredge. You know, I make a little dredge of flour and cornstarch. Or if you're celiac, use rice flour and cornstarch. Or just use all cornstarch if you want and make, you know, flavor that up with some pepper powder that Peter didn't pick. And then I'm going to fry those up, and we're going to put our pickled peppers that Peter Piper did pick on top of those, and a nice, sweet, crunchy pickled pepper on a prawn that has been fried.
Sounds perfect.
Pridefully fried. Yes.
Well, I'm going to do a little stuffed pepper because you have so many peppers.
Oh, I love that.
I'm going to do a stuffed pepper with the rice and serve with sausages. I think a nice little Italian sausage style of sausage, you know, pork and nice little spice of oregano and kind of Italian style that way. And then take the pepper and bake the pepper with the rice in it, obviously. A nice little stuffing of rice, sausages, onions, caramelized onion, fresh herbs, oregano, more oregano, and put that in the pepper, stuff that, and cheese. I'm sorry, I forgot a little bit of cheese. And I probably would use queso or some kind of, I want to use something that's got a little bite to it, like feta kind of idea, where you get
a salty bite.
Yeah,
a
salty bite. A little salty bite through the rice and the pepper, because it's pretty, you know, it's a lot of food, so you want to try to get a little bite through that. And pine nuts, toasted pine nuts. And put that in the oven, you know, in a dish, and then bake it. And then cook your sausage on the side, slice on the bias, you know, put them right next to the pepper, and bon appétit on that one. I would use one of Tom Douglas's mustard on the side, because that sausage is going to need a little dollop of mustard to go with that pepper and that rice, so there is, like, perfect bite combination throughout.
Lovely.
I'm hungry, Tom.
I'm going to invite Peter's brother, Pied, to dinner.
So I thought his name was Paul.
No, it's Pied. He's the Pied Piper. Come on, I got no laughs out of that. This audience is asleep.
Well, maybe the joke is not that funny, Tom. Ever thought about that?
He's Scottish. He's going to be the Pied Piper, which is Peter's brother, Pied. And we're going to make pie because Pied is...
Sure.
You don't ever want to get pied. You want to eat pie.
Correct.
Right, so... we're going to make a pepper pie with tomatillos, but we're going to use sweet tomatillos. It's like a sweet tomato pie, but a sweet tomatillo pie for our filling. Just saute the tomatillos or roast them in the oven. Add some cornstarch or potato tapioca or any other kind of starch that for a thickener. And then we're going to do our filling. So that's kind of like a jam filling almost. And then we're going to layer some sweet roasted peppers on top. And it's really just about creating a different flavor profile, honestly. So, and then it's going to be double crusted. So we got our base crust. We're going to give it a little preamble, a little bake in the oven because I wanted to brown up a little bit. And then we're going to put our tomatillo jam in there, and then layer of sweet roasted peppers. Like, you know what would be good if you don't feel like roasting your own peppers? I love the jarred piquillo peppers from Spain. Those are delicious. But I happen to have a lot of peppers from Prosser.
You still have 49 buckets to go, remember?
I know. Peter and Pied Piper are pickling peppers from Prosser, Washington for this fantastic feast.
What a performance you just did, Tom.
Yes, exactly. All right, they're telling me to wrap it up. I can't imagine why. Up next, it's Food in the News and our Taste of the Week on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We're here at the Hot Stove Society. Terry is begging people to clap. You're literally reduced to begging people to clap.
I am not begging no one. Okay. I'm just participating with them.
All right. The chef in the chapeau is joining me here in the kitchen here at the Hot Stove. And so is Tina Noh, our producer.
Hi.
And it's our Taste of the Week time. And apparently, you lived like a...
Like a slow
romantic movie chronicle this weekend.
I most certainly did. I fell madly in love with Red Mountain AVA. It was so much fun. I got to taste wine via horseback.
So AVA being an agricultural viticulture association?
Yes.
Yes.
So it's just, you know, a designated area where they are growing amazing grapes and mm-hmm. making beautiful wine. It's right adjacent to Prosser there.
Yeah, I think that's Benton County, like a Red Mountain.
Yeah, just it's about a
12 miles.
Yeah, it's about and from Seattle, it's about a 3.5 hour drive max. And it's charming, delicious, fun. Tasting wine on horseback is one of the most fun things to do, I have to say. And, you know, my taste of the week has to be, it was all culminated in this evening where a few of the winemakers from Hightower, Merritt Gaston, and Tap Teal invited me over to Hightower Winery, which was delicious. And they all made me a vegan dish. They did it a potluck style and made vegan dishes from the bounty in their gardens and the local produce there. And it was quite delicious and wonderful. I can't recommend this trip enough, but I will bring you... I recorded a lot. I learned about biodynamic winemaking from... this amazing winemaker named Sarah over at Hedges. So I recorded an interview with her. I talked to the Hightowers about their wine and where to get it here in Washington and how, and you know, the unique techniques that they use in their cab over there. So I'll bring a bunch of interviews and information about that area because I fell in love.
So it's just something that the normal person can sign up for, a horseback riding wine tasting?
Yes, you can. Find that.
Do you just hop on and somebody lead the horse, or do you go on?
Teresa and her husband Jeff, they take you around, and the horses are easy to ride. They're nice. There's one woman who was quite an equestrian, and she got on. She was able to, like, you know, really have a good time and run.
Did she gallop and drink at the same time?
I was.
Well, that's a lot of red wine on your head.
You get off your horse when you
when you
get
drink?
There.
Oh.
Yeah. So
you know, I'll just say, Tina, you're about not even 100 pounds sopping wet, and I'm about 300 pounds such sopping wet. Horses run away when they see me.
And with me, they're like, "Yeah, hop on,
hop
whatever.
On.
I can barely.
Are you on yet? Is what they say, right?
Totally. Yeah. You know, I have to say, I'm a little bit nervous of horses, and the guides there, Teresa and her husband Jeff, were really delightful, and they really helped me feel calm and confident. Mm-hmm. And you really just you ride your horse through the vineyards. You hop off at a tasting room. You taste a little wine. The horses wait outside.
This is when the horse gets scared. Oh my God, they're coming back after that
right,
much
by
wine.
By the third winery, they're like, "Come on, people."
Now, what about the Benton cops? If you're riding along on your horse, can you get a RUI? RWI?
You can wear a helmet if you like. I wore a cowboy hat. I don't wear a helmet. But I'll put some pictures and some more information about how to do that in that area. But it's, I mean, I think tasting wine is one thing and kind of driving around to vineyards or walking around to vineyards. But on horseback, it's really special because you're really in the grapes and you get like a nice walking tour of that region.
So Chef Terry, I believe this segment is called The Taste of the Week. And all I heard was that I'm riding a horse, sipping wine, and somebody made something vegan for me.
Somebody
did you
made
hear
some,
a taste in there
I didn't
anywhere?
Hear
nope.
anything.
Tasty wine had a lot of
so
taste.
What was the food?
I'm going to go back to the wine real quick because I do have some really... One of my favorites was the Malbec over at Fidelitas.
Uh-huh.
You guys had the tasting... They have a tasting room in Woodinville, so you can go there if you don't visit that. But I really loved that wine as well. So I'll make that my taste of the week.
The Malbec at Fidelitas.
Yes.
Okay.
Wow.
All right.
Nice. What about you, Tom?
Can you imagine if Tina was starving to death and she had... Well, no, I'm not even going to go there. What was my taste of the week? Well, I mentioned a little bit earlier the caponata. And, you know, I've said over the years on the show I don't really love caponata. To me, it can often be a big soggy mess. The eggplant and the peppers.
Right. What is caponata?
Caponata is like a stew of
vegetable from the summer from Italy. Mm-hmm.
And if you think about it, it's like ratatouille. With the French make ratatouille.
Exactly.
The same idea, right? So... But normally, to me, it's a bunch of soggy mess. People don't take the time.
I think it's because it's not made properly.
Well, I don't know. I've seen a lot of recipes that turn out as a soggy mess. So my point was, and what made it my taste of the week, was that Jackie is a fanatic for doing each vegetable individually, mm-hmm. right? So, and by doing that, you change the dynamic all the way to the end. So if you put all the eggplant, the peppers, tomatoes, onions, and everything in your casserole and start to cook it, you're going to have a big mushy pot
right.
of...
You're going to have a wet, mushy stew. Yeah.
Instead, she roasted the eggplant. She baked off the cubed eggplant in the oven until it was dry and got rid of a lot of that moisture, right? She caramelized some of the onions, put the capers and olives in at that point, right? And then just chopped in fresh tomatoes at the end. Now, you could have done even that. You could have roasted the tomatoes and dried those out, too. But we ended up as a pasta sauce, and I really liked, well, it was awesome flavors, everything from her garden in Prosser. But I liked the end product from the effort it took to maybe take 10 extra minutes to keep everything separate. Right. Now, it also takes a few extra pans, and I do the dishes in my house, so... I was working hard at that. But the point being that it was worth the effort, right?
No, absolutely. I think I'm the same way. When I make ratatouille, there's no way I put everything in one pan mm-hmm. at the beginning. I see all my vegetables separately. Then I mix them together. When they've cooled down a little bit, I put them together, finish the seasoning, and that's when I have my ratatouille stew ready.
Yeah.
It's a much more enjoyable item that if you just layer vegetable and put them in a casserole like they...
That's a tillon, right?
You just lay it down and make the ratatouille like that. It's fine at home, but there's a better way to do this, I think.
And in France, with ratatouille or caponata, I like to serve it with crusty bread as an appetizer.
Oh, yeah.
Is that typically the way it's served?
Yeah. Grilled bread is a big thing.
As a pasta sauce, it was unusual.
Right. You don't normally serve... I mean, you can serve ratatouille, especially if you want to do a vegetarian pasta. It's a great dish to do. Mm-hmm. But I would definitely take breadcrumb and put it on top. You know, take that grilled bread and crush it on top of your pasta. Give it a nice little texture of grilled bread. Mm-hmm. That would be delicious.
All right. You got a minute, Chef.
I made polenta. I haven't cooked polenta in quite some time. I made a polenta, but I made it with a vegetarian, in your honor, Tina. And it was sweated leeks and chanterelle. Sweated some leeks in olive oil and then added chanterelle sauteed into that stew. Fresh seasoning, fresh thyme, little chopped basil, and then put the polenta that I just finished to cook. I put all this into the polenta and Manchego cheese grated into that, and it made a really delicious polenta. Mm. And I haven't had polenta in so long, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do this more often. This is a great thing to have in the fridge. You can make a little square, you know, you put that in your Pyrex pan in the fridge. Then you take a little square of that out for lunch, put that in the oven, and you have a wonderful little lunch on your hand.
How did you find a market that had leeks that had already exercised?
You know what? The leeks, I brought them back from Shire Island from my friend who has a house there, and they have a garden, and they had leeks in the garden. So there we go,
joke.
Tom.
You missed my joke.
Oh.
It's a day of missing your jokes today. It's weird.
I'm sorry. I didn't finish.
Let me say that again. Okay. How did you find the grocery store that had leeks that had already worked out, that they were all sweaty?
Not easy in this joint.
Sounds delicious. I would do that in a heartbeat. Up next, it's Brittany Bartleben, pastry chef from the Dahlia Bakery on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show. This is Tom Douglas.
And that's Terry Rotsuro, the chef in a hat.
It's time for the Baker's Corner. Brittany Bartleben is here, chef of the Dahlia Bakery and Dahlia Lounge dessert program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And welcome back to the show. I feel like you took a week or two off.
It was a couple weeks, yeah.
Where have you been?
I was in Idaho. Took a little road trip with my husband and son. Went to Silverwoods, the amusement park there, and... Coeur d'Alene, and it was super fun. Yeah.
Researching potato desserts, maybe?
Absolutely not. That means eating French fries. Yeah, that's what I did.
Isn't there a candy bar, like a potatoes, like
there
a,
sure
the
is.
Spud or
yep,
something like
yep,
that?
There is. Yeah, the Idaho Spud.
The
I
Idaho
believe
Spud.
That's what it's called. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'd have to have if I went there.
Wrapped up in sugar?
It is. Like, it looks like a potato, right?
It
like
sure
a baked
does.
Potato.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So, let's talk trifles.
Let's talk trifles.
You know, we did have a chance to talk with Peter and Pied Piper pickling peppers from Prosser Farm. So trifle makes me want to think the same kind of
yes,
jingle.
Lots of tongue twisters there. Yeah,
okay, so
trifle.
What is a trifle?
A trifle is a layered dessert.
Oh, don't trifle with me.
I was wondering when that would come. I'm trifling, you know. It's a layered dessert, and it's very English. It's typically in this big, beautiful glass dish. It looks like a giant wine glass, I would
see-through,
say.
So see-through,
so
layers.
You can see the beautiful layers. There's usually sponge cake, and the sponge cake is usually soaked with a sort of syrup or booze, if it's me. There's jam and then custard, and it's all layered, and it's beautiful, and I just absolutely love them. I found these little individual trifle glasses, and so I bought them. Of course, I'm just serving trifle all the time because I just think they're just precious. It's a really great way to just use up stuff.
I was going to say, I think of trifle as being probably invented to use up old cake or yesterday's cake.
Yeah, yesterday's cake is perfect for it. Uh-huh. Yeah, because you when the trifle...
I just don't understand who has yesterday's cake because I already ate it. I don't understand that
Well,
term.
If you've been listening to me, I always say make more than you need and put it in your freezer.
That, yes,
so
the, I guess I would
those people who are heeding my words...
It's purposely yesterday's cake.
Yes, yes. But I don't know. It's the end of summer. You've had a lot of barbecues. Maybe you've got some leftover custard hanging around. Or you've got some leftover... Tom's, you're really selling that fried rice. I'm sorry, off topic. So, it's a great time to just throw it all in this beautiful trifle dish. And...
Watching Tom, you look like me now. You look like somebody who's never tried a fried rice from Trader Joe's.
Yeah. Anyway, I think trifle is delicious when you use panna cotta as one of your custards. I use two custards. Panna cotta isn't necessarily a custard. It's just a cream set with gelatin, but it's lighter because of that.
So how do you do that? Do you just set it and then scoop it?
So what I do with my panna cotta is pour it while it's still liquid in the bottom of the trifle glass. And so you've got that. And so that way it sets flat. So already starts you off with these perfect layers. So you pop that in your fridge, let it sit. I personally like for my cake part of it to just crumble up the cake and toast it a little bit. So you've got a little crunch.
Not cubes.
Okay. Just I like crumbles. You get more... more toasting when you crumble it.
You also have a bit of... It feels better into the glass.
Yeah, it packs nicely in there. One thing I want to mention, if you want your cake to be crispy, if you've toasted your cake like I've just mentioned, you want to then build your trifle right when you're going to serve it.
Right.
So you've got your panna cotta set, then you add your cake crumbs or whatever you're going to do that, and then you can do... What I do is another layer of a different custard. So I've talked about diplomat cream before, so that's... pastry cream that's been lightened with, say, whipped cream. And so it's this really creamy, lovely pudding. So that's what I top it off with. And then I just pile the rest of it with berries.
You can also do a lemon custard. I've done
custard. Lemon custard. So my diplomat cream, as I've mentioned in the past, is lemon curd, pastry cream, and whipped cream all mixed together.
So are you getting chefy on this? You know, I guess the question being that I think of trifle as being kind of this cubed cake.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of dumped into the bowl, and then you pour pudding over top and whipped cream on top.
You're thinking of like the banana pudding
But you're getting a little bit chefy.
I am getting chefy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's
how many layers? Do you do multiple layers of cake?
So if I'm doing the individual ones, or say you want to do it even in a little mason jar or something, I do... a layer of panna cotta, a layer of cake, a layer of a different custard, and then I top it usually with more cake crumbs and then fruit.
And
It just depends on what time of year it is.
I mean, this time of year, it's great to use berries. Because starting to be too ripe, it's a great place to put all those berries and, you know, just... Because ripe berries taste really good, but they just look kind of not so nice.
They don't hold up very well.
So it's a great place to put those kind of berries and...
It's the perfect place for that, yeah.
And then I finish with cake, a little bit of whipped cream, and then some beautiful thinly sliced overripe pear on top. So you have a pear and berry kind of
gorgeous.
Rifle.
Gorgeous. Yeah. I've done the sort of spins on that kind of gross banana pudding that, you know, that layered with vanilla wafers. I don't know why I'm looking at you with this, because you're not going to know what
you're looking
about.
At me, and I'm looking back at you.
Yeah, Tom knows what
like,
I'm talking about. Exactly. He probably hates it as much as I do. Yes.
I'm looking at you back like,
yeah,
like
what
English?
Are you talking about? So a very classic American dessert is those vanilla wafers and then instant vanilla pudding and sliced bananas. And you kind of layer the whole thing up, and then the time that it sits in the fridge, the vanilla wafers soften. And it's almost like our disgusting, horrible version of tiramisu. How the cookies soften a little bit. So yes, I would say that's a more chefy spin on that. But classic English trifles are really, they're kind of a show-stopping dessert.
Are they?
Yeah, they take the time to make those layers perfect. It's usually a really delicate sponge and a nice homemade custard, and then a beautiful...
I've seen it with orange confit, like slice of orange really cooked gently in syrup and... You know, put it around the outside. I mean, then some people get a little bit fancy with their trifle.
So I like to have my own little American revolution there. Let's fix this disgusting Nilla pudding thing that they're doing.
I'm with you on that.
Yeah,
I don't even know what that is.
But less
I'm
fussy. Less. I think the time they put into these beautiful layers, and sometimes the cake is even like fanned around the sides of the dishes. Mm-hmm. I think you don't have to be that fussy. It's more about the ingredients that you're using.
I bet there's a great British baking show on this subject.
I'm quite certain there probably is. There's a new season on Netflix that I haven't gotten to yet, guys. So no spoilers, but I'm really I've set aside some time for that. So
You know, I did. I was asked to be a judge on the Great American Baking Show.
Oh yeah.
And I did an interview by Skype.
Really?
And oddly enough, I never heard back.
Oh boy.
Yeah, exactly.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah,
he said, please, would you call Peter to pick my plum to put in your pudding?
Are there worldwide desserts that resemble the trifle? You know, like there's every country has a meat on a stick. Does every country have a...
Well,
have a dessert like this. I think country's got a rice pudding.
Or like something in a dish that's pretty. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, tiramisu, like I mentioned.
In France we have many layered cakes. I'm not sure that I can think right away of one in a glass like that, but we have something similar in terms of, you know, laying cake and cream. Mm-hmm. Cake and cream and fruit or berries is a very... I think a lot of countries have one of those desserts.
To me, it calls out in my head when I think about that dessert for that lacy kind of angel hair caramel over top. Would that be pretty on a trifle?
Yes, absolutely.
I've only seen on croque and bouche and things of that nature. But so, how would somebody go about making that little lacy?
It's like sort of like a sponge
hair,
sugar.
Yeah, sponge sugar.
So how we would take one of those wire whisks that are right behind you, and then cut off the bulby end of it, so it's just like these frayed. Mm-hmm. Metal, you know.
Mm-hmm. Literally with wire cutters, you keep one in the house for that.
Yeah,
for that
and then you're going to caramelize some sugar. And then once it's at the color that you want, you dip that in the caramel and then... Shake it back and forth.
So what, over wax paper?
Over wax paper, or we've also done it over two dowels that are sort of sticking out from the countertop, and the dowels catch it.
You take your mother's broom and you stick it onto the counter, and you put some weight on it, and you just... spun the whole thing, and then you clean up the kitchen because it's actually a
really easy thing to do if you're getting ready to serve.
Yeah,
it's not something you want to do ahead of time, especially when it's humid out. But
it melts fast.
And that's trifle for you. It's a perfect entertaining dessert. It's a showstopper, like I mentioned. People, you're going to get a big ooh ah when you bring it to the table, and it's not that hard.
No,
it's
here's the thing though, and this might be a little bit disappointing if you've got a crowd. You cannot get it out of the bowl looking nice.
Oh, no.
It's a pile on a plate.
Yes, it's a pass it around and dish
it
yourself up.
It is definitely not meant to
unless you manage to find those perfect little individual trifle cups.
That's
like
the way
I
to
found.
Do individual
or ones, at home, a mason jar, I think, is just precious.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, it's definitely a mess on a plate.
Yes.
Which is fine. Which is
totally fine.
Okay, so that's we're not going to trifle with you any longer. We're going to move on to our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. And, you know, you haven't been here in a couple of weeks.
I'm a little rusty.
Which means that I've lost a couple of times.
Oh!
I'm hoping you're a little rusty and you're going to take it easy.
Yes, I'm a disaster.
All right. Up next, Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Brittany's got a TAM, which means she is rusty. On Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
Exactly. No one, Brittany's got a tan.
We are back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's time for Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia. The chef in the chapeau is going to be a formidable opponent. Chef Brittany Bartleben, fresh off of vacation, is going to be rusty as heck.
And,
we are definitely counting on that.
Your co-host, Tom Douglas, right here.
All righty. Would you like me to administer this quiz for you, Tom?
I think that would be fine.
All right. I'm certainly happy to do so. Here's how the game is played, in case you haven't heard the show before. Each of our contestants here will get five questions. Whoever gets the most correct is the winner. All right. So, Chef Brittany Bartleben, should you lose today, what would you give away to Michelle?
Brunch for two at the Dahlia Lounge.
Mm, nice.
Ooh.
Nice. Good stuff there.
Tasty.
It's a $75 value.
Yeah.
Fun. All right, Chef Thierry?
What? Brunch for two at Luke. See if I can top that. Value, $25. No, just kidding.
You can cut that. Delicious. Those are really generous gifts. Chef Tom Douglas, what about you?
We have a cool Alpenfire cider dinner coming up here at the Hot Stove on the 20th of September. And so I'm going to pop in two tickets for the Alpenfire cider dinner.
Nice.
If you go to hotstovesociety.com, you can read all about it.
Wow.
Wonderful, wonderful prizes. So Michelle's a winner no matter what happens. Who would like to go first?
I'll start.
All right, Chef Thierry, how did pound cake get its name?
The recipe is very simple. It's 1 pound of each ingredients that goes into the cake, and that's how it gets its name.
Very good. All right. Question number two. Which of the following vegetables is indigenous to Europe? Potato, tomato, cabbage, or parsnips?
Parsnips.
That was easy. Yeah. Nice job. All right.
I mean, you knew the answer. I didn't have to tell it, but...
All right, Chef. What makes sourdough sour?
The fermentation leaven that goes into the rising of the dough.
Yeah. Wow. You're killing
it
today.
Fire.
That's three for three. Question number four for you. A key ingredient of hummus is tahini. What is tahini made of?
Sesame seed.
Or for four.
What, we need to make this blown away.
We need to make this tough.
What, do you have low expectations?
I know. I'm like, God, every question I answer right, she goes, I can't believe he knows that.
Well, you're so fast. You're answering them so quickly, Chef. All right, question number five for you. As fall has returned to our area, pumpkin spice lattes are on the menu at Starbucks. What year did Starbucks premiere this iconic drink?
Now, that was not a very fun question, was it?
Now, I'm going to give you some options.
Let me call Howard. Hang on. I don't know.
Want me to give you some options?
I'm going to guess.
No? Okay.
Yeah, give me some options.
You have some choices.
Okay.
1999, 2010, 2001, or 2003?
I'm going to go with the pumpkin latte. So, 1999, where was I? Rovers.
That'd be 20 years ago, Chef.
20 years ago. I'm going to say 1999.
The answer is 2003. All right, that was a great job. Four out of five correct. Chef Brittany Bartleben, are you ready?
I'm terrified, but I'm ready.
All right. I think you got this. According to Beef It's What's for Dinner, what is the most popular cut of beef in the United States? You have some options.
Please, yes.
Strip steak, T-bone, ribeye, or center chuck roast?
I like ribeye.
All right, you got it.
Yay.
Ribeye is the answer. Good job. Chef Brittany, what makes a perfect Manhattan different from the original iconic Manhattan?
Is it the orange?
No.
No.
Really? What
no,
do you, what,
no.
what do you
the
think?
The orange bitters?
The bitters.
No.
Nope.
It's the half dry vermouth, half sweet vermouth.
Oh, I never would have known that. I'm not a Manhattan drinker.
Me neither.
Me neither.
No. Good job, Tom. That was good.
But Tom knows his booze.
Yeah.
Thought I did.
All right. Question number three for you, Chef Brittany. Using the classic six-turn method, how many layers of butter does a sheet of puff pastry have using this technique?
You're going to have to give me some multiples if you want me to answer it.
Okay. Is it 947?
No, not that one.
729, 234, or... Five.
Let's go
234. 729. Your answer is 729. Sorry.
You tricked me, too. I thought you were giving her that.
I was reading her.
Was that definite?
She goes 734. Would never be that.
Sorry. All right. Brittany, Chef. I mean, Chef Brittany. It's the rice. It really screwed me up. Chef Brittany, question number four for you. The Spanish alcoholic drink Cali Mocho is a mix of cola and what? You have some options. Red wine, vermouth, white wine, or beer?
That all sounds just awful.
Cola and, right.
Let's go vermouth.
The answer is beer. Red wine. All right, what's the difference between bacon and pancetta?
I would imagine the way it's cured.
Yeah, okay. That's it. Right, pancetta is simply cured. Bacon is both cured and cold smoked.
Great.
All right. Two correct, three incorrect. You're on the board. That's all right. You never know what's going to happen.
Welcome back from vacation.
Let's ease back into it.
All righty. Chef Tom Douglas, are you ready?
As I'm going to ever going to be.
Your first question, true or false? Peas and tamarind are both members of the legume family.
Sure.
That's correct. The answer is true. They are. Yep. What state was the chocolate chip cookie born?
What state?
Mm-hmm. You want some options?
Pennsylvania.
Nope. Not even one of the options.
West Virginia.
Nope. Massachusetts. What is the process of making traditional lox?
Cold smoking? Curing and cold smoking?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. That's the answer. Good job on that.
You want a recipe? Or?
What is the purpose of flash frying?
So you don't overcook something? You flash it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. What else?
Well, you can pre-fry, say, French fries, and then you finish them at the end.
What's it doing? What's flash frying doing?
It is super hot, and it's burning whatever it touches.
It's finishing.
Including your fingers when you put them in there.
It's finishing the product.
The answer we're looking for is locking in juices and flavor.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got other questions. You want to skip that one?
No, I got it wrong. It's fine. I take it like a man.
All right. You have one more question left, and you need to get this one correct in order to beat Brittany Bartoleven.
Who only got two right.
That's right.
Let me see what I'm going to do.
She's laughing because she's like, oh, he's not going to make this.
No, he might.
All right, your last question, Chef Tom Douglas. The ham hock cut of pork is from the spine of the pig. Is that true or false?
Brittany is so sad right now.
I'm so sad.
That's false.
You're correct, though.
All right, we have a loser.
Yeah. Brittany B., not your best showing today.
All right, so we get to give away brunch for two to the Dahlia Lounge. Congratulations. If you want to be part of the show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter, or sit right here in our audience and man up to the microphone. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Sorry. This show is produced by Large Media. That's LARJ Media. Our sound engineer is the Shawns today. And our production assistant is Abigail Leong. Special thanks to all the folks at Hot Stove Society, Nina, Janet, Nils, for helping out. If you'd like to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. Also, remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or Apple Podcast, or go to the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Very nice.